I am now recording.
So behave ourselves.
Sort of like the Bible, everything you say is now on record. And then you have to live with it forever. That's it. Anyway, thanks for coming back to the folks who were here last week, and nice to have the folks who weren't here last week have a chance to drop in. For the folks who weren't here last week, you can kind of catch up on your own. There's only one handout. It's the same one each week. Sometimes I come on a handout like lots of papers the first week and then more the second week and even more the third week. I figured this way, if you missed, you know, one of the sessions or couldn't make it to the last session, you can read ahead. And if you weren't here last week, you can catch up. But very, very briefly, okay, am I close enough to this? I get like a gooseneck for this, right? So it
actually
comes in.
Actually, it goes to your chair.
It goes to my chair. Now it goes to the floor.
Sorry.
Technology, it's everything that's cracked up to me.
Thank you.
So very briefly, what we covered last week was the beginning of a combination of a chronological survey of how Jewish tradition, going from its earliest layer on its way to our time, first began to address some of the consequences of monotheism. The belief that there's only one God, which is one of the things attributed to biblical religion. That would be actually an interesting course by itself, because there's some debate about, you know, when exactly that emerges full-blown, but it's not so crucial for our purposes. And as I mentioned in the beginning of last week, when you have one God and you have the three propositions that often follow from that, that eventually the idea of that one God emerges, that that God is all-powerful and that God is benevolent and all-good and there is real evil in the world. One of those three things needs some adjustment to kind of hold the system in balance. And we started to look at last week in some of the earliest attempts to do that. So one approach we've done is chronological, and we'll continue to sort of look at things as they emerge from the biblical to the rabbinic, through the medieval, you know, the mystical, up to the modern period. And the other is conceptual, because many of the ideas that Jewish tradition generates over the centuries about how might we accommodate, explain, respond to, bear with, endure, transcend the problems of evil in the world. And by the way, you know, that range of things I just said is because not everyone's got the same problem with evil as everyone else. I mean, we all kind of bring our own stuff to the table, right? There's global evil, there's, you know, climate evil, there's moral evil, there's medical evils, there's all kinds of things that can be agitating and disruptive in our spiritual lives. So we have different concerns about what we bring to that. Within that, we'll look at some things that tend to cycle back and be reinterpreted, sometimes adjusted, and then applied in a new setting, even though they didn't originate in that setting. And especially at the end of this week, and when we go into the final week next week, we'll see some of the attempts to bring things that used to work into the post-Holocaust era, where it becomes somewhat painfully clear that no amount of reinterpretation really is going to make some of those prior attempts to explain or understand why there's evil in the world palatable, because the context, you know, has changed in so many ways for us. So what we covered last week was the kind of quirky idea that in the early days of the Bible, going back like 3,000 years, our idea of the individual, person, soul, the uniqueness that each of us understands ourselves to be, was pretty much subordinate to the idea of the collective. And as long as the Israelite people, the Jewish people, the covenant with God endured, individual episodes in life that were less than benign, I don't know how much more kindly I can put that, could be absorbed into that bigger story. And the folks who were here last week, remember I said, you know, if there's the metaphor of God is the ocean and we are the waves, the biblical period was mostly worried about the ocean. The rabbinic period has discovered the waves, and that's where we're picking up this week, okay? Do you have any questions or clarifications, especially the folks who are just coming in, about where we're picking up? Okay. So one of the things that helps on a Thursday night, you know, late in the evening, even with daylight savings time, is if I don't talk quite as much as I did last week and you guys have questions or comments, I hope you'll feel free, like, just to, like, put them on the table so the conversation goes. And Marin will remind us to use a microphone for people who might not be present but are tuning in, or however that connects with the stuff.
Or are present and don't hear well.
Okay, yeah, and if I'm not loud enough, you need to let me know that also, okay? So we covered page 1 and page 2 of the handout last week, and where we left off was at the moment when the prophetic tradition, then moving into the period of the Talmud, takes on the idea of evil being a consequence of what prior generations did. And for the folks who were here last week, you'll remember, and for the folks who aren't, it's the metaphor that the prophets and the Bible uses is the parents have eaten sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge, which is mostly meant to mean the parents have behaved in a way that was unethical, immoral, non-covenantal. And the consequence of that is generational. Okay? So it's what in the Eastern tradition sometimes is called karma, right? In the more general sense, consequence. The things that we do have an impact in the world. You know, we drop our pebbles in the pond and they continue to ripple out through the universe. So we saw at the bottom of page 2 that the prophets who lived through the destruction of Jerusalem in 586 before the Common Era were the first to say, that's the way it used to be understood, but it won't be the way we understand it going forward. God has changed the rules on this, and it's no longer going to be the case. Everyone is responsible for their own transgression, but innocent people do not inherit the guilt of prior generations. And that's codified in the Talmud in teachings on the bottom of page 2, okay? So we're starting on page 3 this evening, okay? So that's now we're all on literally and figuratively the same page. So remember I said last week some of you were kind of like struggling with this idea that we never really get rid of anything in Jewish tradition. We just layer over it. And I use the analogy or the metaphor of those transparencies we used to put on our projectors when we were in school. Our kids, we don't know what we're talking about, but when we were in school, you know, you said those transparencies, which doesn't mean the ones underneath it aren't there, right? You can peel them back also. And so certain things come back as an attempt to endorse or use tools, you know, from the Jewish toolbox of prior generations. So, for example, at the top of page 3, I titled this one, you know, Consequences of Covenant Violation. And this is the residual belief that you must have done something. There's a cause and effect that explains evil. Okay? So I brought you three or four texts. None of them are particularly pleasant. So I just want to say that that I don't endorse any of these positions, but just like, you know, the awkward uncle who still shows up at your Thanksgiving or Seder meal, and you don't really want to kick him out of the family because who else is going to take him in? But he says things that are kind of embarrassing, and you have to explain to the people who are new at the Seder, yeah, that's like our wacko uncle, and he says stuff like that. The rest of us don't take it seriously. These are the wacko uncles, in my perspective, of Jewish tradition. Now, if you find what they say compelling, then I apologize for the adjective of wacko, because maybe you like to sit next to that uncle at your Seder. Someone has to sit with him, right? But I just wanted to show that this cause and effect thing, I don't think I brought this source here, but just to jump ahead for a minute, just, you know, it never really goes away. And there are a number of teachers and rabbis, for example, in the sect of Hasidism that's called Satmar. Some of you may know that, Williamsburg in Brooklyn. The Satmar Hasidim are basically, you know, of the opinion that you can explain things like the Holocaust in the same way that you can read these texts. You know, we didn't keep the Torah and all the Jews were abandoning Judaism, and God, you know, did what God does when the Jews do that, and that's why there's the Holocaust. Most of us would find that, I hope, you know, morally troubling, and not all Hasidic sects endorse that, but I'm only bringing it to the table, as ugly as it may feel, to say that, you know, certain things just never go away, and what's on the bottom of the transparency continues to work for some people. Anyway, so the text is Avot de Rabbi Natan, which I don't know if Rabbi Sandberg spoke about at Torah Treks last week, but it's an extended commentary on the section of the Mishnah that you probably know as Pirkei Avot, the Ethics of the Ancestors. So here's the text. Why do scholars die young? It's an interesting question. It is not because they are adulterous, and not because they rob. So it's not, you know, direct cause and effect there, but because they break off from studying Torah and engage in idle conversation, and they do not begin where they left off.
How's the weather?
You get smoke.
Yeah. So here, what the last part of this means that when they interrupt their Torah conversation, they forget where they left off. And so they don't really answer the questions that might have been.
So they die.
Well, according to this unattributed opinion, that's one person's opinion. Remember, this is not Judaism speaking. There is no such thing as Judaism. Okay? There's Judaisms, but there's no Judaism, and there is no voice that goes with it. So, you know, it's always a helpful reconstructionist reminder. You have to put an S at the end of everything, right? Judaism.
Where does this question come from? Why do scholars die young? I didn't know scholars died young.
Well, they don't all, but and it obviously was the case that it must have happened in the context of the people who are reporting this conversation. We don't know who they are, by the way. You know, discussions from the rabbinic period are not always attributed. They're often recorded, but not always attributed. That's where you get the phrase, the Talmud asks, as opposed to Rabbi Yossi asks. Okay? So someone, it's a rhetorical question that someone has raised. Now again, remember, some of these questions may be put out there to make you prepared lest you come across the problem before it's arisen. So, for example, my Bible professor's theory of the book of Job, which we talked about last week in the Bible, the book of Job in the Bible about which we talked last week, which my Bible professor would have appreciated that I just made that correction. His theory was that was a book that was written at a time that the problem of evil was really coming into its full-blown development, as the idea of the individual self was coming into its full-blown development. And the point of the book of Job was to prepare you for the question before it hits you in the face. Right? So this question may be, you know, the question that's tied into that. It does not explain, by the way, whether other people, in fact, die because they are adulterous, right? And other people die because they rob, right? So like I read in the Times today, like the great-grandson of the Gotti family, the Mafia family, 25, it's his turn to go to jail. Right? It's keeping the family tradition, right?
Like four mitzvahs,
they... Yeah, like four generations, like they all go to jail. So it tells you that, you know, visiting the sins of the sons. Anyway, I just recorded it here. I don't want to spend a lot of time on it, just to show you that it never quite goes away. So the second one gets a little more complicated. Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar, so now we have an attribution. He taught even Moses and Aaron died due to their sin, meaning their own sin. As it is stated in the Torah, the Lord spoke to them and said, because you didn't believe in me to sanctify me in the eyes of the children of Israel, therefore you shall not be able to bring this congregation to the land which I've given them. That's the story of striking the rock. Okay? So there's a cause and effect. Right? So the Rabbi Shimon imagines God saying, now we're out of the Torah quotation, now we're in the realm of imagination, had you believed in me, said God, and spoken to the rock like I told you, your time would not have yet come to leave the world. Apparently even Aaron and Moses died due to their sins. That's cited in the Talmud in the Tractate Shabbat. So there's like good news and bad news here, right? The good news is nobody escapes the responsibility for their behavior, even if you're Moses and Aaron. And if they didn't escape it, the basic teaching here is most of us are not Moses and Aaron, right? So we have to be careful about everything that we do. But it also says, you know, if you follow what you're supposed to do, then your time would not come earlier than it's supposed to. This, by the way, is a whole different course, which we're also not going to do tonight. But there is a pretty strong Talmudic sense of, I think a very healthy Jewish sense of the acceptance of mortality. The question of evil is never why do we die in Jewish tradition. It may be in other traditions, but that's not a problematic question for Jewish tradition. Jewish tradition from its inception all the way through accepts mortality as the condition of creation. It does not wrestle with that we're born and we don't get to live forever in this world. It really doesn't. Which doesn't mean, by the way, there isn't some rabbi, by the way, who does. But by and large, it's not a question for Jewish tradition. Early death, circumstantial death, the death of children, death that causes, all kinds of awful consequences in its wake. Those are the deaths that raise the problem of evil for the Jewish tradition. Like, how did that happen? Like, why would that happen? But mortality itself is not necessarily, a problem for Jewish tradition. It's part of the deal. And there was a whole rabbinic teaching that everyone sort of has an appointed lifespan in the world. And, the ideal thing is to be able to live it out and not have it, cut short. If it's cut short, at least one teaching is, it's a consequence of you having shorted the system. Yeah,
was
please.
Was there anything specific that Aaron did that...
No, Judy, you get like sound effect answers here, right?
Sorry.
Well, it depends, I'm thinking of the Mikado, to let the punishment fit the crime, right? My object all sublime. Let the punishment fit the crime, for those who remember Gilbert and Sullivan, or if you don't, it doesn't matter. part of what happens, Judy, in the Bible layer of this stuff, I'm not just speaking to you, but I'm saying to everyone who's listening in here. Sometimes we have punishments that are in search of crimes, right? So, and I think many of you know our son's name is Nadav. In the Bible, there's a Nadav. He goes with his brother Avihu, and they're the two guys who get zapped at the entrance of the tent of meeting for bringing the wrong kind of incense or some ritual violation that's kind of the ritual equivalent of running a red light when you just got your driver's license. Not a good thing to do, by the way, but it doesn't mean like you should be executed, right? You'd like to think you get a second chance, right? Or you get a warning. So very often we don't know, right? So, with Aaron, it could be the golden calf. It could also be that he doesn't tell Moses, wait, don't strike that rock. That's the sin of omission as opposed to the sin of commission. The point I think they really want to teach here is that everybody's equally responsible. And if you like that part of Jewish tradition that revels in the brutal humanity of our heroes, King David, the killer adulterer, the guy we sing, David, Melech Israel, right? Same guy, right? the Bible doesn't shy away from this stuff, right? Yeah, see? Now, when you tell the story of, his adultery with Bathsheba, the song doesn't sound so great, right? All right, let's not get hung up on this too long. We'll keep moving. We get to see the ministering angels. We just did this one, yeah? No, sorry. Same page in the Talmud. The ministering angels said before the Holy One, blessed be he, master of the universe. Now we're rolling the clock even further back. Why did you penalize Adam, the first man, with the death penalty? In other words, like, why is there mortality at all? God said to them, I gave him a simple mitzvah, one thing, and he violated it. Right? That's the fruit. They said to him, didn't Moses and Aaron, who observed the whole Torah in its entirety, nevertheless die? The Holy One, blessed be he, said to them, citing the verse, all things come alike to them. There is one event to the righteous and the wicked, the good and the clean, the unclean, to one who sacrifices and one who forgets to sacrifice. As is good, so is the sinner, and he who swears, as he who fears an oath. That's from the book of Ecclesiastes, last part of the Hebrew Bible. So the book of Ecclesiastes, basically takes the position of, you know what? It doesn't make a whole lot of difference what you do. The same stuff happens, whether you're a good person or a bad person. Now, I want to say, by the way, there's 24 books in the Hebrew Bible, and that's the minority voice of Ecclesiastes. The other 23 books mostly say it actually doesn't make a difference what you do. The book of Ecclesiastes says, doesn't look that way to me. I know I've said to you guys before when I've been sitting in this corner of the room for another evening conversation that I'm very grateful that the rabbis managed to slip the book of Ecclesiastes into the Bible. Because in any human life that that lasts long enough and has a modicum of self-awareness, there's going to be one day of the year where you feel like this. Right? Mm-hmm. And probably more than one. Where you say, like, I don't get it. Like, you know, I do all this stuff and I keep getting schmeiced. And, you know, except for John Gotti, most of those mafia guys are like on vacation in Sicily. Like, well, what am I doing wrong here? Right? So I find it comforting that our ancestors figured, yeah, we can slip that voice in for the moments when that's the way it feels. And that's an authentic Jewish voice also. And it's not considered heretical. It's not considered, you know, a bad thing to have there. Yeah, Shoshana.
It's funny meeting that, because I guess I always, in my mind, Judaism was more of the, you're not dying because of your, like, there wasn't, it wasn't because you were afraid of punishment or something, or you were going to die or something like that. It was more of like doing good things because you do good things, not because you don't not do bad, you know what I mean?
And so, right, you're not doing it to store up mitzvah points.
Right? I mean, that was like what I thought Judaism was, really.
Yeah, and I think that that reflects our, probably, you know, much of what our contemporary understanding of Jewish tradition has come to be for us as modern Jews. And I think quite naturally, and it's helpful that you put it on the table, reflects our tendency to read back into the tradition, appropriately so. The rabbis are doing the same thing. You know, the perspectives that have emerged for us as meaningful. Right? And I think on some level, you know, what you're raising is one of those philosophy 101 questions from our freshman years in college, right? Which is, do we do the right thing because it's right? Or do we do the right thing in order to earn a reward? I mean, is it right in and of itself? And did the, you know, so you know that that's a Talmudic debate. You guys probably know the Debbie Friedman song, you know, what's it? Schar mitzvah, right? It comes from the Talmud anyway. The reward of a mitzvah is you get to do another mitzvah. Right, the reward of a mitzvah isn't that you're stacking up mitzvah points, right? Like how many boxes of Girl Scout cookies you can sell so that you get to earn the merit badge. It's, you do the right thing because it's the right thing, because it's what's expected of you in the world. And what I've been going through with my confirmation class this year, like I'm trying to get, you know, 16-year-olds to understand the idea of expectation and obligation. Right, which I think is kind of a good question for 16-year-olds. Not just what do you like to do, but what's expected of you, right? And I think so much of Jewish tradition, I think, as you helpfully put on the table, is about, like, you know, there's expectations on us because of how they shape the world that we're in, not because of how they shape our eternal salvation. It's much more of a Christian sense, you know, like what we do here, you know, really affects where we're going forever. Jewish tradition isn't so much into that piece. So thank you for adding it to the conversation. What else? Okay. Anyway, we're going to move out of this in a moment, but I gave you three citations that seem to endorse that biblical voice that speaks of cause and effect, okay? Now, here comes the opposition. Rabbi Ami said, "It's been taught there's no death without sin and no suffering without iniquity." Now, I put in brackets there, at the end of the discussion on Rabbi Ami's statement, it was held that after all, the Talmud concludes on this page, there actually is a death without sin, and there is a suffering without iniquity. And that page of that tractate of the Talmud, right, Talmud's a big set of books, this is just one voice, is tied back to the passage just above it. That's the echo of Ecclesiastes. Mm-hmm. You see the continuity? Ecclesiastes said, you know what? We can't actually explain why good people don't get what they seem to deserve and why bad people seem to prosper despite their malfeasance in the world. And, you know, there's really no answer to that. That's the voice of Ecclesiastes, and it's the voice of this page of the Talmud. See how it jumps, like, over, you know, 500, 600, 700 years. Just as the other three voices we first looked at tonight, A, B, and C, are those voices of cause and effect resonating from the earlier layer of the Bible. So we got two voices from the Bible, cause and effect, and you throw up your hands, I have no idea why. And they resonate in the rabbinic period, cause and effect, or you throw up your hands, I have no idea why. And again, I'm grateful that they record the Talmudic resolution here that, you know what, you can't explain why everything happens, and it's probably better not to try to do that. Anything about this one before we go on to another discovery of the Jewish tradition? Okay, so there's this tradition, which is now Roman numeral 5, the bottom of page 3, called in Hebrew, Yisarin Shel Ahava, the chastisements of love, which I telegraphed last week to you as what we know as this hurts you more than it hurts me, right? This is the idea that, you know, because God specifically cares more about you, God has singled you out for punishment in order to put you back on the right path. So don't see it as a sign of abandonment by God. See it as a sign that you are especially appreciated. So you get these teachings. Again, I have to say, I hate pulling, you know, verses out of context and throwing one sentence at you. It feels terribly unfair to the people who wrote it and terribly unfair to you. Having now apologized for that, I will now throw them at you. So, a random verse. Happy is the person who, when afflicted by sufferings, does not rebel against God's justice. Okay? I don't know what's going on, but I believe in God nonetheless. Now, that's an echo of the book of Job.
Yeah.
There's a verse in the book of Job, which most of you know. It makes its way onto bumper stickers in evangelical churches, and it had its resonance for many Jews during the Holocaust. And the verse from Job is, though he slay me, yet I will believe in him. Though God, you know, like, takes my own life, I still believe in God. That, by the way, you guys know from the song that surfaces and often said on Holocaust Day and in the Yizkor service on Yom Kippur, I believe in the coming of the Messiah, and though he tarry, nonetheless, I still believe. Now, that's the positive way of saying the same thing that's said here negatively. Okay, we have no evidence that seems to indicate the Messiah is coming, and we believe anyway. Okay, so that's one way of working this out. Or you get the ratcheting up in citation B. Rabbi Joshua ben Levi says, one who accepts gladly the sufferings of this world brings salvation to the world. So, you know, the first version is you just sort of accept it and you don't, like, scream at God and say, why are you doing this? Second one says, you say, hit me again.
Bring it on.
Yeah, bring it on. Right? I'm so grateful to suffer for this because it enables salvation to come to the world. That's a little bit weird because it sounds for many Jews like an echo of the early Christian tradition. Mm-hmm. Like the suffering of Jesus on the cross is the only thing that can bring salvation. Right? Only suffering can bring salvation.
That would make you passive. Yeah, in the face of world suffering.
Yeah, that's also a really interesting question, that it makes us passive in the face of world suffering. And you know where that's debated a lot right now is in the Western Buddhist tradition. You know, the Buddhism that's come to North America in the last century, especially the last half century, which tries to teach on some level making your peace with things you cannot change while not falling into the trap of passivity in the face of resisting evil. And if I can remember to bring it in, I'll try to remember to bring it next week. I'll make a note that would help. There's a whole recent issue of one of the American Buddhist magazines called Lion's Roar, which used to be called Shambhala Sun. And I think you'll probably find it online, which is devoted to that issue. Western Buddhist teachers, there's a point to this, by the way. We're not doing Buddhism tonight. But most of the Western Buddhist teachers are Jewish. And so there's a big overlap in this stuff. I mean, really, you know, I mean, Sharon Salzberg, Joseph Goldberg. I mean, really, it's like amazing. And they're struggling with the same thing.
They don't consider themselves Jewish.
Some of them
Sharon
do.
Does.
Yeah, Sharon does. Sylvia Boorstin does. A number of them do. Mm-hmm. But they're struggling with the same thing. It's the same question. And by the way, it's asked in our tradition as well. I'm just saying it's one of the things that's being struggled with there. And again, this is probably a minority voice. It's not a majority voice in Jewish tradition, which we should have mentioned last week, by the way. Majority and minority voices, helpful to keep in perspective. Just because one person says something doesn't mean you know, that it's what everyone believes or even what most people believe. You ever been to a synagogue board meeting that goes too long? Right. So if you go to a synagogue board meeting that goes too long, you know, the unanimity starts to break down as people's exhaustion starts to set in. And there's going to be like a minority opinion, but it doesn't mean that's what everybody believes. Okay. Anyway, at the end of this, one is bound to bless God for the evil, even as one blesses God for the good. Is a teaching of Jewish tradition, which if you turn the page, I thought having shared that tradition with you, I should at least tell you what the blessings are. Because this is really an interesting tradition. So when Jewish tradition teaches at the bottom of the prior page, where we just turned the page, that you need to bless God for the good as for the evil, that's an affirmation of everything's got to be understood within the scope of monotheism. You've got to find a way to shoehorn this stuff into the bigger picture. You don't get to say, God is responsible for everything that's good and not for anything that happens that's not good. That's not what Jewish tradition says. But it's our tradition is a prescriptive, ritualistic tradition. So it's not just like a nice idea. Jewish tradition then says, well, if we're supposed to bless God for the good as well as the evil, what are we supposed to say? And so here's what you're supposed to say. So the blessing, you know, when you hear good news, right? So, like, I hope you get to say this often, is, you know, the proverbial Baruch Atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech HaOlam, HaTov V'HaMeitiv. God is good and makes good things happen. HaTov V'HaMeitiv. Which, by the way, if you can just remember that, it just becomes kind of a nice reflex. You know, like if my wife comes home from work and I ask how did things go at the Jewish Federation today, that's where my wife works, and she has something good to say, you know, like, you know, they finally hired an associate director for our department, which means she's not doing two jobs. Happens to be Rabbi Nathan's wife, by the way, is the person who works with my wife. Was hired a while back, Abby, but the day that Barbara came home, Barbara's mine, and said, you know, we hired Abby, I said, HaTov V'HaMeitiv. Right? It's just like a nice thing to learn as a Jew, like to be able to say. You don't have to know a whole lot of Hebrew to learn HaTov V'HaMeitiv. Like, work on it. Practice saying it. Like, you know, here's something good. You know, put it next to your computer or your email or your phone or whatever it is. You know, try to learn to say HaTov V'HaMeitiv. It's a nice phrase. Yeah?
But you're talking about hearing good news and hearing bad news and hearing having good and having evil. So I don't see evil there. I hear bad news, which to me doesn't really sound like the evil portion. Evil is evil.
Yeah.
So bad news.
Good question.
Is somebody hit you in the rear end of your car? So that's bad news, but it's not evil necessarily. So I'm not sure where you were headed with the good and evil of God. That's difficult to understand sometimes. Why is he doing that?
Yeah, there isn't a blessing. There isn't a blessing for God allowing evil. Okay? It doesn't say, I mean, this blessing is different. It doesn't say Hara the Haraiv, right? Or something like that. The one who is evil and makes evil. It's not the inverse of the good blessing. So it's interesting what this translates. That you say this, you know,
so
you say
the one that is good and makes evil.
No, you don't get to say that either. We looked at that last week, though. That's a good memory, Joe, that you've got there, right? That's what we say after the Baruch Hu in the liturgy. Baruch Atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam Yotzer Or Uvarei Choshech Oseh Shalom V'Ra'et Hakol. Quoting Isaiah, I am God who makes all things light and dark, good and evil. That's what Isaiah says. By the time that makes it to the prayer book, remember we said last week, it's I am God who makes all things. I make light and dark and everything else, not good and evil. They're not so comfortable. They flatten good and evil out to everything else. You asked a good question, so let's look at what you actually say, and maybe it'll be a response, not an answer, but a response. So when you hear bad news, you're supposed to say, Baruch Atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam Dayan HaEmet. God is the true judge. By the way, I don't know if you know, but that's the blessing for cutting kriya. When you cut the ribbon, that's traditionally what you recite. So it's actually what you say when you hear of a death, which traditional Jews mostly limit that to, because it's definitive. You don't say Dayan HaEmet when you hear that someone's gone to the hospital. because that makes it sound like you've decided they're going to die. You know, so you don't, you say it for something that's definitive, Dayan Ha'emet. So it's a blessing on something that's irreversibly evil. You can't imagine it's going to change. It can't be undone. And it's also what Jewish organizations, when they're astute, put in the subject line of bulk emails. Yes. Like when a congregation sends out an announcement that a member of the community has had a loss or someone has died, it's really better to say in the subject line, Dayan Ha'emet, a loss in our community, than it is to say death announcement, which some Jewish organizations do, which is really kind of creepy to get in your email. Right. I once pointed this out, you know, when I used to work for the Reconstructionist movement, and I worked for the Rabbis Association, when we would have a loss in our association, we would, the subject line was like Dayan Ha'emet. So if you're a member and you get that email, you know you're about to hear that someone in the organization has had a loss in their family, or, you know, someone in the organization might have died. And I used to belong, and I still belong to the Reform Rabbis organization also. I used to get stuff from them and say, death announcement. Yeah. Yeah, so I said to them once, you know, it's like lo na'im. It's not nice. Like, can't, and like, you send it to a group of rabbis. We have a modicum of Hebrew, you know, literacy here. Can't you just say, like, Dayan Ha'emet? So they say now, Baruch Dayan Ha'emet, which is also the shorthand for, like, blessed is the true judge. So I just want to say before we come to your question that when I cut kriya with people, I ask them to recite this in Hebrew, you know, if they're comfortable. But I don't translate it this way. I say to them, you know, the translation of this is God is the true judge, which in our time we understand to mean something like beginning to come to terms with the things we cannot change. That's my Reconstructionist take on God as the true judge. It's beginning to come to terms with the things that we cannot change, which is what kriya is. That's what a funeral is, right? It's why funerals in Jewish tradition are brief and why placing the earth in the casket is so powerfully painful, because it's all part of, you can't pretend this isn't happening. This is like real time, right? So it doesn't answer, you know, in the abstract sense, the question that you've, I think, appropriately and helpfully raised, because where we're going to end up at the end of next week, you guys probably know there's not going to be an answer to the question of why. There's only going to be responses to the question of what now. Right? And that's where we'll end up. Larry, you've been patient. I hope that I haven't derailed you.
You actually may have answered the question I had, but the taking the Hebrew literally, I guess, is as close as I can do it anyhow, is sort of a throwback to the, it happened because it was your fault, that God is a judge, and this bad thing happened because God judged that was the appropriate punishment or consequence.
Yeah, that's one refraction of it. I want to say in support of what I think is the majority voice in the rabbinic tradition of Judaism, and I mean majority here, probably around like 66%, not, you know, 95%. True judge, I think, in its best way, to me its best way, is an echo of Job. Remember the response that Job gets from God? If you weren't here last week, I'll just, you know, gloss it briefly. When way at the end of the book of Job, God finally shows up. What God says to Job, according to the person who wrote the book, again, remember that someone wrote the story. God doesn't actually say this to Job, all right? They're not recording this having happened, right? They're making up a story. But what that person thought God said was, you couldn't understand if I told you. You're talking about eternity and the cosmos, and you're going to live maybe 80 years, as it says in the Psalms, right? 80 years by reason of strength. 80 years. You couldn't begin to understand it even if I could explain it to you. So I think, Larry, Dayan Ha'emet is used by a lot of people in Jewish tradition who like the Whitman sampler version of Jewish theology, which is, if you look on this side, there's a whole bunch of threads that don't seem to make a pattern at all. Don't understand anything of what's going on here. But if you flip it over, lo and behold, like, you know, there's the picture, there's the motto. And what Dayan Ha'emet, I think, means for those people is God understands what it looks like on the flip side. All we get to see is the other side. And depending upon what your faith is, you get to the other side, you'll see it the way that God sees it. So the true judge, I think, in the way that I like it as a rabbi and as a Jew, should put it the other way, the way I like it as a Jew and I use it as a rabbi, is you can't really understand the bigger picture of this. You simply can't. And you can't actually know all the consequences of this. You know, there are certain things that my wife insists, for example, are part of who I am that I would not have if, for example, I hadn't had the loss of a parent early in life. Now, I don't think God, you know, made that happen so that I cultivate, you know, these psychological and emotional resources that my wife thinks are enviable in me. There's things she doesn't think are enviable. She doesn't blame God for those either, by the way. But as you guys know, right, from your own experience, we harvest things from difficulty that maybe we would have learned some other way. But I often wonder as I get older, I'm not sure. I'm just not sure if I would have like been able to get there without that experience. Would I be okay if I didn't get there and I could have like passed on that experience? Yeah, I think so. Right? But when I get to that stage, I do think of this like sampler model. I mean, I find it helpful that I just don't know like the bigger picture. And people in the Eastern traditions, you know, use the same kind of reference. You simply don't know the consequences of the whole chain of effect from something you say, something you did, something you know. It's just hard to know. Someplace in the world at this moment, I'd like to think there's some rabbi who I knew as a rabbinical student who's thinking of something I said or taught. By the way, they might be disagreeing with it. That's okay. But I have no way of knowing, right? In the same way that I drop my teachers into the conversation here, they have no way of knowing, you know, that I'm thinking of them. So we simply don't have, I think, the biggest picture of this stuff. And that's an okay thing. I think that's part of our humility. Yeah. Elaine, are you holding the microphone, or do you want to ask something also?
Yeah, I'm maybe going to say something quite irreverent, but I would say,
I don't know what that would be in a Reconstruction synagogue.
Exactly.
Go for it. It's okay.
When I read this, all this other stuff, without the interpretation of saying, I would say this is the root of evil.
This is the root of evil?
No, this is the root of evil.
So say a little more.
Well, say that somebody is sick because they're evil. You know, when I look at karma, okay, you know, and the whole caste system, mm-hmm. I don't have a problem with me saying, hey, there could be karma. So think about your actions may have echo in the world, mm-hmm. you know, or mm-hmm. recoup, even make bad things come back to me. But to have the audacity and the arrogance to say that person's suffering and I'm having such a privileged life because I must be such a good soul mm-hmm. and such a terrible soul. I find in the room a lot of this stuff if you interpret it literally. You know, honestly, I think so. God, you know, that Moses, who lived such a life and went on a trek and that he's being punished for hitting a rock. I mean, like, you know, come on. I'm sorry.
That's also a punishment in search of a crime.
Honestly, you know, an Aaron who tried to hold the troops together by doing something, you know, whatever. I just, you know, to find a fault and find, you know, forgiveness, but why would we believe in God who would be so like that? And so in a lot of this stuff, without the twist of what you're saying, I would say, I want nothing of it, and I find it the root of evil because there's a foment's arrogance. Mm-hmm. You don't even have any compassion. You blame other people's hardships for their own faults. To me, it's the root of the evil and perpetuating any judgment. So, you know, I struggle there. So, you know, irreverent, you know, sorry.
Yeah, I don't think it's irreverent. I think you put your finger on two things that are consequential for us. And, you know, one I take responsibility for, which is Jewish tradition never reads text literally. It doesn't read the Bible literally, and it doesn't really read its own rabbinic traditions literally. It's like every other human project. It's language that's stretched to what one of my teachers, Paul Van Buren at Temple University, there you go. See, I mentioned someone I studied with years ago. He wrote a book called The Edges of Language, in which he said that, you know, when you use language that we use for everyday discourse to talk about things that are just on the edge of what we could imagine trying to comprehend. You're bending that language into a zone where it can't function in the way that it functions when we're talking about human things. So as a Reconstructionist example, right? There's some place in Mordecai Kaplan's writings, right, the founder of Reconstructionism, where he takes on Maimonides. Maimonides said, God is a unity, but not a unity like anything else is a unity. God is unique, but not in the way we use unique to talk about anything else that's unique. Because there are whole things of negations, like God is these things, but not the way we normally use any of those words. To which Mordecai Kaplan said, in which case, you're actually saying nothing at all. Right? Because if we're using that word, but it doesn't mean anything like what we mean when we use that word for anything else in our realm of experience, you might as well not use the word. Right? Which is, I think, a valid critique. So you're marching in good company with people who can't read the text literally. So, you know, again, like I take a little bit of responsibility for putting text in front of you that can just sound jarring, you know, and inappropriate. But on the other side of our planet, you know, coming out of the Eastern tradition, as I've learned, you know, from my, you know, 10 years that I've been spending now going to meditation retreats with Buddhist teachers, they struggle with the same issue around Buddhist and Hindu understandings of karma. It sounds just as weird and as offensive to many people in those traditions because it's the same kind of text. You know, look what caste I'm born into. I must have been really great in the last life, you know? And they're trying to explain that's not what karma means. That's not how karma works. That's the Hallmark card version of karma. That's a bumper sticker version of karma. And I think what we see is that cause and effect is a pretty lousy way of trying to understand, like, why bad things happen in the world. Just, it's not helpful, right? But the caboose I want to end to this, I said two things, and I'm going to say, like, 2A, oh, right?
I'm sorry to interrupt.
That's okay.
What was the name of that author of Edge of Language?
Paul Van Buren.
Oh, okay.
The book is called The Edges of Language.
Thanks.
Yeah. So that's okay. I'll have to remember what 2A was in a couple of minutes. I'll come back to it. No, it's okay. It's you know, one of the interesting things about being 65. My wife says memory is becoming a team sport in our house. Between the two of us, if you give us enough time, we can remember what one of us was trying to think of, right?
That's a great description of it.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's, and you got to be careful where you yell it out, right? You know? Because, you know, these things come to you, and if you're sitting with the person that you were talking about a half hour earlier, you can say, oh, you know, or the name of someone, right?
Yeah.
So I got to tell you, because I can't resist this story. My wife and I were trying to remember when we were much younger what you called the little piece of cigarette wrapping paper at the very stub of the marijuana cigarette. So anyone remember what it's called?
Yeah, roach.
Now we could not remember the word. So we're in a restaurant. It's a true story, I swear. And we're sitting there, you know, and we order the food, and I look at my mom and say, "Whoa, roach." I say, you cannot make this stuff up. The waiter comes over and says, "You never yell roach in a restaurant." So I'm just saying, you know, you got to be careful, right? So you want to know what the bonus Jeopardy question is? What did you call it when you took all the roaches and rolled them into another cigarette paper? Does anyone remember that? No. I was a bomber.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was at Woodstock, trust me.
I remember seeing you there.
That's right. Weren't you at Sinai? That's what we said at Woodstock. Didn't they see you at Sinai? Anyway, we've digressed. I just love that story about the roach. I'm just saying, like, right, when you can't remember something, like a half hour later?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You stopped talking about it, right? And all of a sudden, like, yeah, there you go. So I'm saying, like, 2A will come back to me at some point. I don't remember what it was.
And if it doesn't, you're going to die.
All right. So I'm going to move through some of these a little bit faster just so we stay on schedule for next week. Okay? So down at the bottom, I'm going to skip some of these about sufferings are beloved of God, because you get the general idea, okay? If you skip down to the bottom of page 4, we're at G here. Yeah, we're good on time. Rabbi Yonai said, you saw this, nothing's in our hands. We can explain neither the prosperity of the lawless nor the sufferings of the righteous. So I gave you this insert. There are some that explain that even though it is just that the wicked has it good and the righteous suffers, nonetheless, we do not grasp the reason of the thing. And it's from the truths the argument for which our knowledge does not grasp. See the book of Job. That's what Jeremiah said. You're correct, Lord. If I argue with you, yet I'll explain, you know, why does all these things happen? So this is Rabbeinu Yonah's teaching. And about this, we know that there is truthfully an argument for the matter, but we do not grasp to know it. Now, before we turn the page, some of you may remember reading Harold Kushner's book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People. I mentioned it last week. One of the things he says at the end of that book is that there are two kinds of people. And it's not the proverbial, those who think there are two kinds of people and those who don't. It's not that one, right? But there are two kinds of people. Those for whom any answer is better than no answer, to go to your question, Joe, that you put on the table. And those for whom a bad answer is worse than no answer. So let me repeat that, because they're not exactly opposites. Those for whom any answer is better than no answer. I don't know where this fits into the larger picture in God's plan, but I find comfort or take faith in or believe that in the context of eternity, this fits some way that I can't understand. And there are people, and let's be fair, they could be us or they could be our friends or our family, and I don't want to make it sound like that can't be a position that you hold, you know, for whom that's really important, right? If I didn't believe that this was all part of a bigger thing, like, I would go crazy. You ever heard somebody say that? I mean, it's pretty. I've heard it in hospitals lots of times, right? You know, people don't say, like, I need to know what that bigger thing is. Because, as Job said, that would really make you crazy. But they say, like, I've got to... Then, in what Rabbi Kushner says, the other position is, you know what, a bad answer, I think, to go to your point, Elaine, is, for some people, worse than no answer. I'd rather believe there's no answer than to think the answer is that you did something and you got punished. You hit the rock and you got killed. You know, you did this and that happened. Your parents did this and it happened to you. And what's the bottom line for that is that that's a really subjective thing, which is, if you believe that there are those two kinds of people, by the way, which you might disagree with, okay? But if you buy Rabbi Kushner's argument, even just for the sake of argument, you don't have to take it home and swear to it, which of those people are you? And that's really subjective. That's about everything, you know, what's plausible to one person, the person sitting right next to them, said, you got to be kidding. You actually believe that? That doesn't tell me anything about the idea. This is like the great, to me, the great reconstruction, among the great reconstructionist insights. It tells me nothing about the idea. It tells me something about me, and it tells me something about you, right? So I know what Mark thinks, and Mark knows what I think. And neither of us knows what's true in the cosmic sense. And what's interesting to me is, tell me a little bit more about why you believe that. How did you come to that? Did you ever think differently? Like, how does that work for you? That's an interesting conversation to me. You know, I'm trying to debate whether one of us is right and one of us is wrong, or I've got the truth and you're... That's not so interesting to me. I don't know how you would know the answer to that stuff anyway. Anyway, I don't want to sermonize to you guys, but I just wanted to be clear about that piece. You doing okay energy-wise?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We're going to flip the page. Two things are coming that might be helpful. Right? The rabbinic tradition creates two things that the Bible tradition doesn't know. Okay? Judaism evolves, and different eras innovate. Parentheses, by the way. Another great Reconstruction thing you can take home. In pre-modern religious systems, innovation always masquerades as interpretation. Isn't that a great bumper sticker? Innovation always masquerades as interpretation. You heard me say this to you guys, because I've taught about Israel for so many years. I've said this in so many times when I've been here. When the rabbis of the Talmud changed the laws of the Bible, they did not say, hey, we're changing the laws of the Bible.
Mm-mm.
Mordecai Kaplan could say, hey, we're changing the laws of the Bible. But the rabbis of the Talmud say, oh, lucky us, we just discovered what the laws in the Bible really mean. No, that's, you know, that's interpretation. But it's innovation, but they can't say they're changing the words of the Bible, because to them the Bible is the word of God from Moses. You don't change that. You can only interpret that. When you get to be a modern Jew, like Reform, Reconstructionist, Conservative Judaism, you don't have to pretend that you're interpreting, you're innovating. You just own it. Mm. Right? Say, yeah, this didn't exist in Judaism before, but you know what? Maybe this is what we need now, so let's make this, right? So like Reconstructionist synagogues, right? Democracy in Judaism. Got to tell you, it's not in the Bible. You know, there were no ritual committees that voted on building the golden calf, right? There was no Reconstructionist process, you know, that went through, you know, how to invade the land of Israel. You know, that's something we internalize from modernity, and we say, let's try that and see if it works for Judaism. It's innovation, right? Anyway, what the rabbis innovate. Big overture to the, I hope it's not anticlimactic. They come up with two things that, you know, might be helpful. One is the explanation for evil becomes the internal debate between our good impulse and our bad impulse. And the other thing they come up with at the bottom of page 5, then we'll go back to the top, is the idea that this world is not all that there is. The people who lived in the time of the Bible, they only had a frame of reference of this world. This world was all that there is. So the idea that when you die, you go to heaven, or there's a world to come, or a messianic era, or this is just the overture to eternity, the Bible people don't, they wouldn't know what you were talking about. And they're not stupid by that. They just would not have any idea what you're talking about. It's like saying to people who live 500 years before the common era, Jesus died for your sins. And say, who? I did what? For what? Not because they're being, they just wouldn't have any idea what you're talking about. Right?
Flatland.
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 Say more. You're giving us a one-word reference that I don't
remember. So Flatland is a book that where everybody's living in two dimensions, and one.
I did not know that book.
Yeah, discovers that there's a third dimension. And
I like that.
Yeah. So it's a social, it's a social commentary. It's like, I think it's less than it's happening.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's just no reality of three dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
So for you to say something about a cube to somebody who's living in two dimensions,
right,
is like is the example that is what you.
Yeah. If you have access, if you either get it or read it online. Very interesting articles about Stephen Hawking's Allah Hashem in the New York Times today. One of the things was his debate, you know, with some of the other physicists that, you know, asking what, you know, gets remembered in the black holes of the universe is like asking what's above the North Pole.
Right.
Was it a very interesting phrase? Like I tore that out and stuck it in my sermon file. I don't know if I'll ever use it, but I like it. It's like asking what's above the North Pole. Right? Kind of interesting thing. Anyway, let's stick with this before we go to the top of the page. When the rabbis invent the idea that there's something after this world, the eternal world to come, they are trying to create an adaptation to enable what's come before, the belief that God is good, that God is powerful, that there's a reward for righteousness, that there's a consequence to malfeasance, can still be affirmed. If you draw a boundary at this life, this world, this universe, it got harder and harder in the time of the rabbis to believe in that. And they just watched the Second Temple get destroyed, right? They're watching the rise of Christianity, the rise of the Roman Empire. It certainly doesn't look like our version of reality. You know, it's a reflection of the way stuff works. So when they invent the idea of a world to come where actually this stuff does all get worked out, but doesn't happen here, they're able to say that what we fundamentally believe is still true, but it's not true in this world. It's only true in the context of eternity. Now, when you get to Jewish modernity, Reform, Reconstructionist, that idea of the world to come where it all gets worked out gets dropped from the official liturgy. Now, individual Reform and Reconstructionist Jews may still believe that. That's totally fine. But as I said to you last week, Mordecai Kaplan says, like, the Bible is this worldly, Rabbinic Judaism is otherworldly, and modernity is back to this worldly again. So what we're looking at here are adaptive responses of the Rabbinic period to the problem of evil by creating these two ideas. So now let's take a look at them, okay? The top of the page, the evil inclination. You guys probably know this tradition, right? The Yetzer Hara, the Yetzer Tov. Remember those cartoons with like the little devil and little angel on the shoulders? Same idea. So the rabbis, when they create something that hasn't been there before, and someone says to them, where'd you get that? Right? They have to root it in some text in the Bible. So one of the texts that they root it in is from the very beginning of Genesis, where it says in the translation, the Lord God, I gave you two F's here because I'm trying to recapitulate what happens in the Hebrew. The Lord God formed the human, Adam, from the dust of the earth, Adama, right? Adam, Adama, earth, earthling. You guys know that tradition. So in the Hebrew, there's a duplication of the letter here, which I tried to do with the bold, Vayitzer. There's two yuds there in the Hebrew, for those of you who read Hebrew or understand the Hebrew. So the rabbis say, grammatically, that's incorrect. Why do you need two-letter yuds there? God made the human being. And so the rabbis say, the two yuds, one's for the good inclination, one's for the bad inclination. That's where we got it from. We didn't make it up. Yeah, it's actually pretty creative. Right? I'm sure, by the way, it's a scribal error. Someone wrote, you know? Someone made one yud, and someone said, are you ready for lunch? And they said, just a minute. Yeah, there you go. And now it's there forever. But, you know, it's also true in the story of Noah, that's citation B, where God's imagined saying after the flood, I will never doom the earth because of humans, since their inclination... I lost the English. Since their inclination is evil from the start. Ki yetzer ha'adam ra min urav. Yeah, that's a bad thing to have left off there. Sorry. You have to write in the end of the sentence. Since the inclination of the human heart is off kilter from the get-go. Right? That's a paraphrase of it. Because once the rabbis, by the way, invent the Yetzer Tov and the Yetzer Hara, the little red and little good angel, then they get into a debate about what's the relative strength of one compared to the other. Are they in balance? Are people basically good? Or are they basically, you know, it's the Yetzer Hara? You pay your money and you take your choice there, okay? There's no answer to that one. There's no vote ever taken on that. So you get, you know, little things like here, like some guy named Antoninus, obviously a Greek name, asked one of the teachers of the Talmud period, when is the evil urge placed in human beings or in man? Answer, as soon as he's formed an embryo. If so, he said, he would dig his way through the womb and emerge. Rather, it's only when he emerges from the womb and takes on life. Now, you might think that that's a story that's just about good and evil. It's actually related to the debate in Jewish tradition about abortion. Mm-hmm. Yeah, some of you probably know that in Jewish tradition, it's only when the greater part of the infant has emerged. Mm-hmm. Not the entire body, but the greater part. Well, if it's breech, it's the other way around. And that's why it's the 50%, right? Once 50% of the child has emerged, then it's got an independent life. And its claim to life in a difficult delivery is equal to the claim of the life of the mother. This is an awful situation, right, to imagine. In the awful situation where the life of the mother is put at risk by delivery of the child, if the child has not emerged or has only emerged less than halfway, the life of the mother takes precedence over the life of the child. And so what they're actually asking the question here is, you know, when does this happen? Now, when I studied this stuff with my wife once, she said, you know, if you don't think of this as a supernatural text, but as a kind of humanistic response, what it's really saying is kind of the nature-nurture argument, that the evil urge only emerges in people when they're out there in the world and subject to the corruption that's present in the world. You know, like they sort of start out neutral. You know, they're not corrupt. We don't believe in original sin in Jewish tradition, right? There's a fly. That's good. It's a sign of the springtime, right? Or leftover shalach manas, right? Anyway, we don't have to spend more time on that. Rabbi Amram was once able to conjure, right? This is like an exorcism, right? Now, please use your imagination here. Judaism doesn't really believe you can do this. Rabbi Amram conjured the Yetzer Hara to go forth from him, and it departed under the guise of a pillar of fire. Then he said, ha, I see that you're fire, but I'm stronger than you are. Mm-hmm. Right? So again, this idea that the Yetzer Hara is something powerful, and our job in the world, according to many of the rabbis, and I think, Shoshana, this goes in your direction of what you said earlier, but I don't want to speak for you, so if I'm wrong, call me off here. Our challenge is to resist. I think, Elaine, you're going in the same direction. Our task, obligation, challenge, expectation is to resist the evil that's strong, right? It can really subvert. You know, it's really easy. As I said to my confirmation class, you know, when one person does something wrong and the next person goes along with them and the third person says, I'm in with you, and that's your social group and you're the fourth person, it's not easy to say, wait a minute, I don't think that's the right thing, because you're going to pay a price for that. Right? It's not easy to do. Anyway, just so you know, in Jewish tradition, that the illness never comes without the antidote. Again, all of these texts from the rabbis are their imagination speaking. The Holy One spoke to Israel in their imagination and said, oh, children, I created the evil inclination, the Yetzer Hara, but I also created the Torah as its antidote. So if you just occupy yourselves with Torah, you will not be delivered into the hand of the evil inclination. And if you don't, you will. Moreover, he is altogether preoccupied with you, yet you can rule over him. So if you translate this into the realm of what's today called spiritual practice, right? Like exercise, or changing the way that you eat, right? It's within our power, if we are diligent and keep something in front of us and maintain our practice, to change the way we are in the world, to cultivate a different way of being in the world. When you frame it that way, what the text is saying is, if you keep in front of you, you know, a refraction or a prescription or lenses, you know, that remind you of how you ought to be and the world ought to be, you will behave more often than not accordingly. And if you don't, it's really easy to be pulled away from that, right? So, you know, the first time you skip exercise, the fringes on the tzitzit are supposed to be similar to that, right? They're supposed to be a reminder. Yeah, that's a helpful analogy or tradition, yeah. But the first time you skip exercise, you can say, oh, you know, I didn't sleep so well last night. Then it's easier to skip it the second day, right? Conversely, by the way, it's okay to skip once in a while, right? Like, don't kill yourself over this stuff, right? So I would say to people, you know, like Judaism is so not an all or nothing thing. Like, you know, when you stop doing something, it doesn't mean you stop doing it forever, right? You can always come back to it. Anyway, we don't have to say much more about the Yetzer Hara, but it is a top of the page. It's a response. It's a response to why there's evil. We have these two inclinations. And if you don't think that it makes sense theologically, it probably makes sense psychologically. Right? Okay. The world to come, which in Hebrew is called the Olam Haba. So one of the problems with the idea of eternity is that it tends to displace the centrality of the here and now. It's one of the problems Christianity had from the beginning. If believing in Jesus means I have salvation for eternity, I guess I could do whatever I want. Right? Not even clear. In the first century, not even clear. Those of you who took the New Testament class with me a couple of years ago may remember we looked at one of these in St. Paul's letter to the church at Corinth, 1st and 2nd Corinthians. The people in Corinth seem to have adopted the idea that, hey, this is cool. Yeah, like, let's party. Right? Hey, we're having a really good time here. Right? Because as I understand this Jesus thing, like, we're home free. We got like a get-out-of-jail-free card here. We can do whatever we want. And St. Paul says, don't quite have it right here. So I'm not going to spend more time on St. Paul tonight. We've been to Buddhism. Now we've been to St. Paul. You know? Next week we go to Minneapolis. Okay, my second Roach moment of the evening. Anyway, so the problem here is that when the rabbis invent the idea of the world to come, they risk displacing the immediacy and the importance of this world. Right? So when you get teachers like Rabbi Yaakov, who teaches in Pirkei Avot, he says this world is like an antechamber. The word in the Hebrew is prosdor, which sounds like a borrowed word from the Hellenic environment. So this world is like an antechamber to the world. It's like, you know, outside the doors of the sanctuary. That's the prose door, right? Notice the sign on your sanctuary door. It doesn't tell people to turn off their devices. You don't have that sign on the door to the hall out there. You don't have it on the outside door. You have it here. So there's an analogy, right? Like your friend does, right? Out there's the antechamber. You prepare out there so you can come into the big room, right? Remember that, what was that movie? Bull Durham. Remember Bull Durham?
Oh, yeah.
What's that pitcher's name?
Nuclelouche,
yeah. How could I forget a name like that? There's a guy, remember they said when he got called up from the minors, I'm going to the show. I'm going to the show, right? So that's the same idea, right? Rabbi Yaakov would have said, you're going to the show, right? So this world is to sort of prepare you for the world to come. In other words, take the long view, right? So here's another tradition. There's a verse in the Bible. I didn't give you the citation here. I'm sorry, in my cutting and pasting, I went through this too fast. I should have proofed it more closely. My apology. But there's a verse in the Bible that says, God is faithful without iniquity. It's probably Exodus 34. Adonai, Adonai, El Rachum B'chanun. Right? Marion will tell us. So the rabbis say, a God of faithfulness. What does that mean? Interpretation. Just as punishment is exacted of the wicked in the world to come, so too punishment is exacted in this world of the righteous for any slight transgression which they commit. Meaning, it's an interesting thing. Righteous people are suffering in this world. They're just burning off their bad karma so that when they get to the world to come, they enter clean. Righteous people, they're okay. Evil people are prospering in this world. They better be worried. Because when they get to the next world, they're really going to be in trouble. Right? They are not burning off their stuff in this world. So it continues, what does without iniquity mean? Just as the righteous receive their reward in the world to come, the wicked are rewarded in this world, even for the least meritorious act that they do. Yeah, I missed the quotations there. So there you go. So God basically is imagined. Again, remember, this is an unattributed, imaginary idea of some teacher in the Talmud thinking that this is what God said, which is, yeah, let the mafia guys have a nice house in this world. Because they're not going to be living in a nice house in the next world. Right? And, you know, if you're living in a tent in this world, okay, you get the mansion in the next world. Any of you come from a tradition of the Russian Jews, by the way? Have any relatives left to ask about having to stand outside and wave at the czar as he walked by? This is probably an apocryphal story, but I've heard it from at least two families that come from Russian Jews. Now, you know, when they made Jews line up on the sidewalk in the Jewish shtetl when the Russian officials or the czar would come through, or the czarina, I'm sorry, here comes the third bad joke of the evening, or their children, the czardines. Okay, I'm done for the night. My son says, can't you, like, dial it back? Sorry. They would make the Jews stand on the sidewalk and, like, wave at them and, like, you know, honor them. And the kids would often cry because it's a pretty miserable experience being Jewish in Tsarist Russia. And I've heard from at least two families a variation of parents saying to them, don't worry, in the world to come, they'll be sweeping up in our house. Mm. Right? It's that kind of, well, you know, Cinderella. Right?
Revenge is sweet.
Yeah, or karma, you know, whatever it is. Like, you know, in eternity, we'll have it better, and in eternity, they'll have it pretty bad. So that's kind of a folk version of this very sophisticated theology of the Talmud, all right? So I'm going to skip the one at the bottom, that suffering leads to the world to come, because I think we've had enough suffering for one evening, okay? Okay, so I wanted to kind of pull this together, and I don't know if we'll get to the medieval period or not. But if not, we'll probably get to that next week. I think it'll be enough for one night to finish the top of page 6. Again, these are traditions from the Midrash, and so we're looking at something like 4th, 5th, 6th century of the Common Era. God says, which really means the rabbis say, okay? God says, the righteous do not rejoice in my world. Should be capital M there, okay? And do you seek to rejoice in my world? Adam didn't rejoice in my world. Do you seek to rejoice in my world? Abraham didn't rejoice in my world. Do you seek to rejoice in my world? If one may say so, say the rabbis, God himself, forgive the gender, does not rejoice in his world. God's not even happy with this world, according to the rabbinic legend here. Why should you be happy with this world? Now, that's kind of, in a way, a nice teaching. Like, the stuff that agitates you and worries you about this world bothers God also. God is not sanguine. God doesn't say, don't let it bother you. It all gets worked out on the other side of the sampler. Right? I mean, this is kind of one of those nice things. Like, God's experience, great imagination. God's experience of disquiet and imbalance is a mirror of ours, or reverse it, if you like. Our experience of disquiet and imbalance is a reflection of God's. I like that. Like, God's as troubled by this world as we are, right? Because look what it says in Psalm 104. You got to know a little bit of grammar here. It doesn't say the Lord rejoices in his works, but future tense, the Lord will rejoice in his works, meaning God will rejoice in the works of the righteous in the world to come. And it finishes by saying, the Israelites, they didn't rejoice in my world. Why do you seek to rejoice in my world? It doesn't say Israel rejoices in his creator, Psalm 149, but future tense grammar, Israel will rejoice in the creator, meaning Israel will rejoice in the works of the Lord in the world to come. God will rejoice in the future. Israel will rejoice in the future. They're not going to happen in this world, right? Now, the takeaway for this evening is, or I'll suggest to you a takeaway for the evening is, you might have another one, Jewish tradition seems unable, even in its most desperate moments, to silence the impulse to hope. It often is silent about the impulse to faith. There are moments in Jewish tradition where speaking faith may seem blasphemous. I mean, say to a Holocaust survivor, it was part of God's plan. Right? See how far that gets you, right? It's like when people say, like, you know, we should forgive people. And, you know, like a Jewish response to that is the people who they assaulted get to decide if they want to forgive them. You don't get to decide on their behalf, right? You know, like the 16-year-olds in my confirmation class after the shooting in Florida, one of them brought in this video of, you know, someone, you know, the Sunday right after that shooting, the first protest was at the high school, and, you know, some well-meaning evangelical Christian was trying to organize a prayer rally across the street to forgive the shooter. Made my kids bonkers, you know? I was glad. I mean, this is a good thing, right? Rabbi's happy that their confirmation class is upset about this. Because they said, like, how can they forgive this person, right? So, Jewish tradition seems to have this irrepressible impulse towards hope, even if it's muted or marginalized. But it never entirely disappears. It may disappear with an individual person, by the way, or even, you know, a group of people. But it never entirely gets repressed. It's kind of irreducible, right? So when people say to me, like, what do you have to believe in to be Jewish, right? I don't say the answer is God. I said, you got to believe in hope and the possible. So that's how I want to end tonight, because many of you knew, many of the people in your congregation knew Rabbi Ira Eisenstein, or knew of him, right? He was the founder of the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College, Mordecai Kaplan's son-in-law. Doesn't hurt to marry into the first family. and he was my teacher and my friend, and in many ways my surrogate father. Not coincidental. Many of my therapists have pointed out, had the same first name as my father. Oh, wow. Isn't that interesting? Mm-hmm. And it was my mother-in-law, by the way, that noticed that my daughter, whose name is Shira, the last three letters of her name were the same as my father. It's like a Freudian nightmare. Ira Eisenstein said so many different times to us when I was a rabbinical student that what's necessary for Jewish life is the belief in the possible. As long as you believe that what is not what has to be and could be otherwise, parentheses for the better, it could always be otherwise for the worse, then you've got the basic Jewish idea. And he said that all of these ideas, you know, resurrection, the world to come, they are all ways of saying, like what Mordecai Kaplan said, that all of these ideas, and he said it about the idea of the Messiah. And for Mordecai Kaplan, the value of the idea of the Messiah was that the world as it is not the way the world ought to be. Said he didn't believe in a Messiah. Kaplan thought the idea of a Messiah was a supernatural superstition, you know, of a different period, something we didn't need anymore. But he said the psychological truth of the idea of the Messiah is that the world as it is not the way the world ought to be. So hope, possibility, potential. At the very end of his autobiography, you can read, I hope you have it in the library here, Ira Eisenstein's autobiography. Not a great piece of literature, by the way. And the title is really schwach, like Reconstructing Judaism. I mean, really, my life or something would have been more interesting. But he was so subordinate to the idea and the movement and to his father-in-law. But at the very end, he said, people have to have faith in something. And people accuse Reconstructionists of having no faith. So, but really, we do. Like, and our faith is in the reality of the possible. He said, will it be enough to get us through and to keep us going? That depends on what we do with it. He said, but it's been enough for him. And he's writing this, probably in his 80s, I guess, from the 70s when he wrote the book. He said, it's been enough to sustain me. Maybe it'll be enough to sustain other people. Right? I think it's a nice insight when we're looking at the question of evil, because we're looking at, as 21st century Reconstructionist Jews. And it's helpful to know, I think, what our tradition of modernity says about this. So sometimes, honestly, when I get discouraged by this stuff, or, more accurately, my kids who are just, as I was saying to Adam, who are just like overwhelmed by the world they find themselves living in, because the world they grew up in wasn't always great, but it wasn't this world. Sometimes I say to my kids who unfortunately had the chance to meet Ira Eisenstein and spend time with him and visited with him, and someday I'll bring in the picture of them when they were visiting him back when they were much younger. Sometimes I'll say, look, what Ira said to us, I pass on to you. You shouldn't forget. Like, it's always possible that things will be different. Right? And the same country that gave us, 8 years of one kind of administration has given us so far 2 years of very different thing. But they're both data, right? And the question is which one you want to invest in, which one you want to bet on. I'm not doing politics with you, by the way. I'm just saying that the idea of the possible is something that I find. It's one of the things, fortunately, I remember Ira's voice. I can hear him saying it. I can see him teaching it. It's one of the things that I really value about having known him and having learned from him. And it's one of the things that keeps me in the Reconstructionist corner of the Jewish universe. I like that I don't have to believe in God. I'm not sure what I mean by the word God. I'm not even sure how I use the word God. But I like the idea that things could be different. And our job as Jews is to try to make them so. So let's stop there. And if you're not here next week, please read on through a little bit of the medieval period from Maimonides. And then we'll jump into the Harold Kushner stuff and some of the mystical stuff that Andrea was alluding to last week. She wasn't able to be with us because she had another class she had to be on. And then we'll try to finish up with this idea that's so prevalent, modern Judaism, tikkun olam, repairing the world, but not in the sense of let's go to a protest march. But repairing the world is an alternative narrative of creation that Jewish mysticism has, that I think is the right narrative for our time. The one that doesn't start by God saying, at the end of every day, God said, look, it's good, look, it's good, look, it's good. That's the Bible. But the Jewish mystical version is the world starts out broken and has to be fixed from the very beginning. And that's the Jewish mystical tradition's contribution to the problem of evil that we'll finish up with next week. Okay.
Thank you.
Good conversation. Have a wonderful week.
Thank you. The discussion about roaches will not be in the newsletter.
All right, I forgot we were being recorded, right? I just want to say, by the way, I was just sitting with people who smoked marijuana when I was 18. I didn't inhale.
Okay, I'm going to start recording now.
The true story, honestly, I tell you the true story, is I think I...